Let me again just say how good it is to be here. I appreciate the warm welcome you've given to me and to Janet. I was supposed to mention this morning, my brother Brian said to give greetings from them. They said hello. And I'll just say this morning, I appreciate so much the really good attention that you gave to the lesson. That's always encouraging, and I do appreciate it. I hope that you will do that throughout this week, that we'll study together. If there are questions that you have about any lesson, anything that's said during the week, please feel free to talk with me about that. The plan tomorrow night, we're going to be talking about the cross of Jesus Christ as motivation. We're going to kind of pick back up with some of what we talked about this morning, but really focusing on what Jesus did at the cross. Tuesday night, I'm going to talk about how that sometimes as disciples of Jesus, we may be seen as narrow-minded, and really going to talk about the nature and the importance of truth. Hope you can be here for that. And then, Lord willing, Wednesday night, we'll close it out with what I hope will be an encouragement to you to realize that disciples can benefit from the bad times they face. I want to give you a list of names, and I want you to tell me, not tell me out loud, but I want you to think about what they all have in common, besides being people. There was Adam and Eve. There's Joseph. There's Tamar. There's Aaron, the brother of Moses. There's the immoral woman of Proverbs, the 7th chapter. And there's John the Baptist. Every one of those, of course, besides being human, at some point or another in their life, what they were wearing told something about them. You think about when you see Adam and Eve in their fig leaves, that's a statement of their sinfulness. When Joseph is wearing his tunic of many colors, it was a clear message to his brothers, that's the favorite. In the 38th chapter of Genesis, Tamar dresses herself in a way that causes Judah to think, this is a harlot. Aaron, he had special garments that anybody that saw that said, well, that's the high priest. And of course, they would be passed down to Eleazar and on through the priesthood. We see the woman, Proverbs 7:10, simply says she was in the attire of a harlot. There was whatever that outfit was, and I don't know what it looked like. It told people, that's a harlot. When John the Baptist came with the camel's hair and the leather belt in Mark 1 and verse 6. I think that's a very clear connecting him back to Elijah. Making, you know, signifying this is that one that was to be Elijah to come. I mention those things to say that sometimes we think as disciples of Jesus, what we wear really doesn't matter. But dress does matter. In 1 Timothy, the 2nd chapter, everybody's familiar, I think, with this passage that talks about the women adorning themselves in modest apparel with propriety and moderation. Sometimes we get into the specifics of this passage. All I want you to note from this passage, verse 10, is, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works? There is that, he said, that would be proper, which implies there would be that which is improper. What we wear sends a message. And it's something we need to think about. We need to give thought to. The world understands that how I dress makes some difference. You know, we see it in business attire. Now, depending on the business, depending on the part of the country you're in, the specific apparel may differ. But companies expect of their representatives a certain appearance. Why? Because they know it sends a message to customers. If there's a bank, they want the tellers to look like people that would take good care of their money. They don't want this sloppiness. There's a certain attire. Team spirit. It sends a message. I can tell you, I can go to Walmart on a Saturday in the fall where I live, and I'm just blinded by all the crimson and white, you know. And then there's that navy blue and orange of Auburn. And then there's, I like to call it the convict orange of Tennessee. You know, there's a lot of that up there. Sometimes I even say it that way when I'm up there. Usually that's when I'm away. But, you know, then there's the little me in my orange and blue of the gator colors. You know, I do feel. The other day, I was there at 7:30 in the morning and got to go Gators as I was walking down through Walmart with my hat on. But anyway, I'm telling you, I don't have to guess what 90% of the folks in North Alabama, who they root for on a Saturday. I can look at how they're dressed, and the message is sent. But then there's also this. There is attire that the world represents as sexy, seductive, sensual. It's intended to send a message of physical attractiveness. It's not intended to draw one's attention to godliness. A lot of the things about dress really have little impact on a Christian as far as being a concern. I mean, I've already said who I root for. It doesn't bother me that people root for other teams and wear some of those ugly colors. I mean, that's okay. You know, as far as business attire, you know, if you work for a company that requires it, then you better wear it. If you work for a company that says, hey, jeans and a t-shirt are fine, wear jeans and a t-shirt. But when it comes to dress, there are areas of concern for Christians. In Romans, the 12th chapter, this, the general principle is we are called upon to present our bodies a living sacrifice. We are to be holy unto God. And we are not to be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Let me just say to you, here's a great challenge. This idea of being transformed versus being conformed. Conformity is easy. It is natural. You may have noticed that I speak with what some would refer to as a southern accent. Do you know how I got my southern accent? I was born in the South. I used to tell people I was born in the part of Florida that was in the South. If you got past Lake City, we considered you'd be back in the North again. But, you know, we all spoke Southern where I came from. And that's why I speak like I do. Those of you from other places, other parts of the country, you don't talk the same as the people around here. Not because you made a conscious effort to talk like somebody from... No. If you want to talk differently... And you will see sometimes some broadcaster, some news personality that is from New England, where they have strong accents up there. Or they're from the South with the strong accent. But they teach themselves to speak with kind of a neutral tone. That takes a lot of effort. You know, I'm happy with the accent that I have, so I've not tried. But when it comes to spiritual things, I can't just let myself blend in and say, well, I'm the way I am because this is where I live. You know, when it comes to my language, just to use that, continue that illustration, it's okay if I say y'all, and sometimes I don't put a G at the end of words like swimming and fishing and, you know, some things of that nature. But I can't let myself, because the people around me are profane and irreverent, obscene, I can't let myself do that. I've got to resist that. Well, the same way, when it comes to our dress, let's not just automatically conform. There may be plenty of things we can do, but it can't be automatic. There's got to be thought put into it. In 1 Peter, the first chapter, he speaks of holiness there. And he says, therefore, gird up the loins of your mind. Holiness takes thought. It is going to take effort. And he says, you're not, verse 14, to conform yourselves to the former lusts in your ignorance. But as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, because it is written, be holy, for I am holy. This morning in our Bible class, we talked from Leviticus. In Leviticus, he taught them to be holy. And as we mentioned, he enforced being different upon them. They ate differently. They dressed differently. They worshiped differently. They were different from the nations around them. There has to be within us a willingness to do that. I'm going to give you three areas of, I think we need to think about. The first one is in worship. God is to be served with reverence. Hebrews 12, 28, 29. He says, therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. For our God is a consuming fire. We live in an irreverent age. We live in an age where the word God has simply become a way of saying, you surprised me. Or you scared me. Or you amazed me. You know, we just, people use that. They use the initials, OMG. It's just, God is not treated with reverence. That's not the biblical picture. Hebrews 10, our worship is a special thing. Therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he consecrated for us through the veil that is his flesh, and having a high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. Worship is a special thing. I find it interesting in Exodus, the 19th chapter, when God told them he was going to come down on Mount Sinai, one of the things he told them in preparation, he says, wash your clothes. On this point, let me say, I am probably about as sensitive as anybody you will ever meet when it comes to making rules that God didn't make. I am absolutely, adamantly opposed to that. I'm not trying to say these, and I'm going to give you a list of these are appropriate church clothes. All I am asking in our age, in an age in which worship is about us and not about God, when God is not treated with reverence, when worship assemblies are no more than social affairs and to be entertained, that we just make sure that our dress doesn't begin to reflect a diminished appreciation for what we're doing. That it still reflects, I understand this is a special occasion. This is about something different. But there's another one I want to think about. And I call this clothing that's message clothing. You know, it's got the words on it. Or it's got pictures. It's got some kind of logo that says something to people. There are some principles in this I want you to think about. Ephesians 5:11. Have no fellowship, he said, with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them. I'm not to be a fellow. Fellowship means to be a fellow. We're fellow teachers, fellow farmers, fellow fans. You know, we share something together. He said, don't share with darkness. Don't be a part of that. In contrast, Matthew 5, let your light shine. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. I have an obligation to make certain that my life in its totality, and I believe that includes the way I dress, the clothes I wear, that it reflects the positive light of Christ. In 2 Corinthians, the 8th chapter, there's one of those texts that it took me a while to come to it. But then I've really come to appreciate it. I've really come to appreciate the mind of Paul behind this passage. The context is that collection being made for the saints at Jerusalem. You remember in 1 Corinthians 16, he said, you know, you take this collection, and he said, you know, whomever you appoint, they'll let them take this to Jerusalem. Well, now it's a little bit later, and he's writing, and he said, these messengers are coming through. He said, they've been selected by the churches. Why? Well, he's explaining why these people are carried. Why Paul didn't have put it in a bag and carried himself. Avoiding this, that anyone should blame us in this lavish gift which is administered by us, providing honorable things not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. Honorable things. Not just to the Lord, but in the sight of men. Sometimes we get caught up in saying, I don't care what everybody else thinks. I know what I meant. I know what I'm saying. And Paul said, I want to make sure there's not any blame given. Now, if you know the story of Paul, you know that there were times people were very angry with him. They beat him. They imprisoned him. Later they would kill him. But he tried when he could to live that life that was above reproach. When we get into things like this, there are, I consider, some gray areas. I'll give you an illustration from sports. And an athlete, Rob Gronkowski, if you know that name, for a few years was the best tight end in football. Injuries have slowed him a little bit. You know, best tight end on the best team we've seen in the last 10 years, the New England Patriots. I happen to like the Patriots. I've enjoyed, you know, they kind of had the NASCAR motto. Y'all know what NASCAR's motto is. If you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. You know, I mean, no offense to any NASCAR fans, but, you know, the Patriots have been a great team. I've enjoyed watching them. But if I were buying a jersey, which first, I don't shell out $100 for jerseys. I would never wear Gronkowski's because of his lifestyle. It's so associated with him. I mean, a lot of the NFL players are not great people. But that's so much a part of his public persona. And yet, I could understand somebody that was just a diehard Patriots that said, this guy's just a great athlete. On the other hand, see, I consider that one, somebody has to make their decision about it. I know where I would fall. But do y'all remember the name Michael Sam? The University of Missouri player a few years ago that was drafted by the St. Louis Rams. And he was openly homosexual. And when he got drafted by the Rams, for a couple of weeks or so, his jersey was the number one seller on the NFL website. Why were people buying the jersey of a guy who ended up not even making the team? It was a statement. It was a statement that no Christian would want to make. You know, there's a case where that's clearly a message is being sent. have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them. A lot of colleges are connected with what I would consider to be false religion. Should a Christian wear a Notre Dame shirt? Does that not, in the minds of many, give endorsement to Catholicism? But what about the Georgetown Hoyas, back when they were really good? Did you know that's also a Catholic school? They were good for a long time before I ever even realized that. It doesn't have that same connection. What am I saying? I'm saying you have to think about these things. I would never wear a Brigham Young, BYU, attire, because it is inseparably connected to the Mormon Church. Whereas Duke University, I won't wear Duke for different reasons, but, you know, Duke has a connection with the Methodist Church. Nobody really thinks of Duke in that. You see what I'm saying? There are things that have... I want to give you one to think about that I used to put in this category of kind of the gray area. I'll tell you where I am right now, and I'm going to tell you where I am right now, is I'm begging people to be on the no side. I'm not condemning. That has to do with the wearing of clothing that features what's sometimes referred to as the Confederate battle flag. I don't want to get into all the arguments about what it was all about. I just know this. If that's what I'm wearing, I am not presenting a welcoming image to a solid 10, 11% of this country. There are a whole lot of people who are not African American who are going to look at me and say, I thought he was a Christian. And you're going, there are people who say, and they will give me all the reasons why it's okay. And all of those may be valid reasons. But that's not something anybody has to do when we're talking about letting our light shine, appearing honorable in the sight of all men, maximizing our influence for good. Then there are things. Had a sister one time tell me. She was up in arms about this. A man got up waiting on the table, and he had on this shirt, and it had dice and cards, and I think it had a whiskey bottle or wine bottle or something on it. And she said, he was waiting on the table. I thought, if he had been mowing the grass in that shirt, that would have been inappropriate for a Christian. You know, here he is wearing something, giving endorsement to that. I'm not going to try to go through a list of entertainers. But there are entertainers whose purpose is to promote immorality. Don't endorse them. There are certain restaurants, we'll call them that, because I think they do serve some food, but their whole purpose is to promote the most ungodly dress that you could ever have. Christians don't need to be wearing those kind of things. That's wrong. That is just something. We're not letting our light shine in all of that. Well, let me catch up to where I'm supposed to be on this. Anytime I say I'm going to talk about dress, I think this is where everybody thinks I'm going. They have no idea I'm going to mention Confederate battle flags or BYU shirts along the way. All that's part of our picture, but this is too. When it comes to dress, I want to tell you, when I was a young child, there was a war being fought. There was a war being fought, not across over in Southeast Asia, that one was going on too. There was a war being fought right in this nation. It was a war called the Sexual Revolution, and decency and morality lost. It's a different world now in when it comes to morality than it once was. People in general don't care what Hebrews 13:4 says. Marriage is honorable among all in the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. You want to get people to laugh. Say something about looking at a woman to lust after her. Is Jesus condemned in Matthew 5:27 and 28? He said, whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Can I ask you to look at Matthew 18 with me? I have seen this repeatedly in recent years from Christians. And it seems particularly from younger Christians and particularly from younger female Christians who will say about Matthew 5, 27, 28, and it will usually be in regard to some expression of concern about dress. Jesus doesn't say anything in Matthew 5 about the woman. He just puts all the responsibility on the man. I will not exempt any man from responsibility. David was not exempted from his responsibility, even though Bathsheba was bathing on a rooftop. But Matthew 18:6 says, but whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe to the world because of offenses, for offenses must come, but woe to that man by whom the offense comes. Let me ask you, do you believe that there is attire that would promote lustful thinking? If you don't think that, you are in the minority. The folks that design the clothes, you know, the folks that run companies like a Victoria's Secret, they're confident that such exists. Jesus said here, if you cause someone to sin, it's a terrible thing. That's not exempting the sinner. You know what he said that time about if the blind lead the blind, they both fall into the ditch. I need to be very careful here. But our fashion industry, they don't care about being a stumbling block. They're not concerned about that kind of a thing. They design clothes to be sensual, to be attractive. I've had a few questions I've just included for years. When we get dressed, we need to ask ourselves, is it too low? A lot of clothes just don't come up high enough. A lot of them are just too tight. I mean, people can clothe their bodies, cover their bodies, but they're covered in a sensual way. Too short. You know, I read a description one time of an outfit. It was Sewell Hall quoting a newspaper editor from the 19th century about a circus performer. But he said about the outfit, it hesitated to begin and ended almost immediately. There's a lot of that these days. Is it just there's not enough of it? Sometimes I see stuff that's covered, but it's too sheer. Again, I'm not the guy who makes the dress code. I don't establish these are the specific items I'm going to say everybody has to wear. But I want you to be honest. Parents, be honest. And look at it. And sometimes what we say, well, I don't know. It might be. No, I don't think it's too. No, you know, we start having these arguments in our own selves. I would offer to you to treat your clothes kind of like we've learned to treat leftovers at our house. You say, like what? You know how leftovers are. I mean, there's no way you can throw out that one spoonful of mashed potatoes. It's got to go in a bowl so it can go in the back of the refrigerator and you can throw it out later, right? You know, but no, I mean, we eat our leftovers most of the time. But sometimes it gets pushed back in there, and then you pull it out. I mean, if you open the lid and it's got mold, that's clear. But sometimes what you go is, you can't remember how old it is. You can't remember what. And this used to happen occasionally. It would open one up and she'd smell it. And I could just see, you know. And she wasn't so sure. And then she'd say, smell this. I'm like, like seriously. You know, let's risk food poisoning on a majority vote here, you know. You think it smells a little funny. I think it's okay. Let's get one of the kids and cast the deciding vote. You know, what we came up with is if we're in doubt, we just throw it out. You know, we're just, I'm not sure how long we've had this. You know, we have any doubt that it doesn't smell right. It's gone. When it comes to your clothes, let's do the same thing in every aspect of this. Somebody says, well, I just believe that God's unconcerned about that kind of thing. That God just looks at the heart. After all, doesn't 1 Samuel 16 and verse 7 say that God does not see as man sees? For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. God doesn't judge people by how short or tall they are, the color of their eyes, the color of their skin. He doesn't judge people by how expensive their suits are or how cheap their clothes are. But is he saying here that there is nothing about a man's outward appearance that God is concerned about? That's a strange thing to say about 1 Samuel 16:7, when in the law of Moses, he gave them descriptions about their clothes. He said on their outer garment, you remember, they had to put the tassels in the corner, had to put the blue thread in it. He gave very detailed regulations about what the priest had to wear. We noted this morning in 1 Samuel 19 that he had the prohibition against they couldn't mix wool and linen in their garments. No, he's not saying that one's dress in any way cannot be ungodly. It's the kind of thing he's talking about. How short are you? How tall are you? How strong? How weak? What color are you? Those don't matter. But when somebody says God's concerned about the heart, they're really starting to get at it, though. Matthew 15, in verse 18, says, but those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and they defile a man. For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. These are the things which defile a man, but to eat with unwashed hands does not defile a man. Why do we dress the way we dress? It usually reflects our heart. A heart that's concerned about reverence. A heart that's concerned about influence and positive example. A heart that's concerned about holiness and not being a stumbling block to others. A heart that's concerned about purity. It's simply going to make different decisions than the heart that says, I don't care what others think. The heart that says, I want to be noticed. The heart that says, I'm more concerned about fitting in than pleasing God. Yeah. The heart's going to affect things. Make sure you have a good heart. I like easy questions. Sometimes I'm teaching a Bible class and I'll get to the near the end and I'll kind of lightheartedly, I'll say, anybody have any easy questions they want answered tonight? This is one of the easy questions. So sometimes somebody, they'll say to me, who gave you the right to make the rules? Well, that's easy. I don't have the right to make the rules. I'm not trying to make the rules. James 4:12 says there's one lawgiver. I don't want to add to God's word, Revelation 22:18. you notice I've not talked specifics about like a dress code. I'm not saying this is what you wear, this is what you don't wear in the specifics of that. I am telling you, God's made rules about reverence and holiness and purity and influence and letting your light shine. And the fact that I can't say this is where the line is doesn't mean the line doesn't exist. When we don't know for sure where the line is, that's all the more reason to back up a little bit. To be cautious. I made mention that Janet's from West Virginia. She's from the mountains. She's also afraid of heights, you know. If you ever find her at the bottom of the hill, you know, she was pushed. I mean, you know, she's not going to get close to the edge. I'm that kind. If it's a good, firm, solid rock edge, I'm out there trying to lean over it all the while she's saying, where's the insurance, you know. I mean, I like, but then, sometimes I go into places, there's not a rock edge. There's this ground. And I can see it's crumbled here, it's crumbled. I don't get near that edge then. I keep my distance. I'm not trying to say, I mean, I know, and usually I go, I know I could probably get a little closer. But I'm at a safe point right here. I want us to have pure hearts that say, I don't want to cross that line. And if I have to stay back just a little bit extra, it's worth it to be sure I haven't crossed it. Last objection I hear sometimes, somebody says, well, especially on this sensuality, I can't help it that some people have dirty minds. And there is some truth in that. I'm reminded in 2 Peter 2 of how he speaks of those whose eyes were full of adultery. There are men in particular, it's more men than women, though they're not exempted. But men who truly do have dirty minds. Who it doesn't matter how modestly, the purity with which a woman dresses, they may look at her in the wrong way. And there is nothing you can do about that. But I'll take you back to Paul. Do you think there were any people in the first century that it didn't matter how you did it, they were going to accuse him of being in it for some wrong reason? Trying to make a profit for himself? Trying to build himself up? But he still said, I'm going to take caution. Instead of just saying, well, if somebody may think that anyway, no. He said, we're going to take every caution we can to provide things honorable, not just in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. If they look with lust in their eyes, with hearts that are full of adultery, or eyes full of adultery, lust in their heart, at least know that it wasn't your fault, that you were not the one causing them to sin. You don't want that millstone tied around your neck. Folks, our clothes say something about us. I mean, there is no doubt about that. What do they say? Are they saying the right things? Are they saying these are a people of holiness and reverence and purity? Go back to 1 Peter 1, that which was our focus text. And I know when I talk about this, it's not easy. And I'll have to say, it is not easy, particularly for the younger folks. But, look at what He's done for us. Verse 18, knowing that you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold from your aimless conduct received by tradition from your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. The Lord who calls us to holiness, who says, be holy, for I am holy. He gave His life for us. If He gave His life for me, I can dress the way He wants me to dress. I can live the way He wants me to live. I can talk the way He wants me to talk. I can be holy. I hope this will help you think on these things. I want us to live for the One who gave Himself for us. Tomorrow night, as I said, Lord willing, we're going to explore that death of Christ a little more closely. We'll be spending a lot of time in Matthew 26 and 27. But I hope tonight, as we close, if you're not His child, you've not made yourself a disciple of Jesus, not received that salvation in Christ, you would make that decision tonight. Come to Him. Allow us to baptize you into Christ. Or maybe a child of God fallen away. Why don't you return? If we can help you, come while we stand and sing together.